You're listening to the Digital Void Podcast, where we explore digital culture, media, technology, and memes, featuring critical and empowering conversations with experts at the forefront of our digital moment. My name is Josh Chapdelaine, and my co-host is Dr. Jamie Cohen. Welcome back to the Digital Void Podcast. Happy New Year to you, and thank you for joining us on a great first episode to kick us off with the first ever four-time guest, Grafton Tanner. Grafton is someone who deeply inspires me, as his books The Hours Have Lost Their Clock, Babbling Corpse, and The Circle of the Snake all speak to a great and important philosophy about the role of nostalgia in our digital moment. But this year, we're going to be engaging more with you, the Digital Void audience. We're fresh off the heels of our final Caveat Festival, Visions for a Better Internet, and we're preparing to release insights from the show as a guide to help promote the visions of the speakers as shared by us here at Digital Void. Additionally, we're exploring all types of events, from live podcast tapings to workshops focused on creator labor and rights and more. Do you have an idea for us? Let us know. We'd love to hear from you. Now, here's our conversation with author of Foreverism, Grafton Tanner. Grafton, it is wonderful to welcome you back to the podcast. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be back.
I think it's the fourth time you've been on the podcast, and it's a wonderful time to celebrate the release of your new book, which is already available internationally, but not yet available here in the United States. It will be releasing on January 23rd. It is called Foreverism, and it builds upon the wonderful work that you've released over the last decade, including books like Circle of the Snake and The Hours Have Lost Their Clock. So I wanted to, before we dive into some of the stories, outline some of the key theory and history that you expertly outline in the book. From nostalgia to foreverism, what are the medical roots of nostalgia, and why is it important to understand the roots of nostalgia today?
That is a good question. And I guess I'll start by saying that the purpose of writing this book called Foreverism was to take a previous argument that I had made in the last book, which was called The Hours Have Lost Their Clock, and it was about the history and politics of nostalgia. And in that book, I argued that our society today, in the Western world today, has a real issue with nostalgia, partly because we live in a relatively heavily nostalgic time period in which lots of people are looking backwards because of lots of unstable moments in history, like the COVID pandemic and economic, you know, hardships and collapses and all of that. And that is sort of like creates the necessary breeding grounds for lots of people to experience that emotion. And so my goal to write Foreverism was to actually take that argument, turn it upside down, shake and see what falls out, you know, and kind of argue the opposite. In other words, to say maybe in fact we don't live in a particularly nostalgic society. Maybe it's the opposite. Maybe we live in a society that's still very much trying to eliminate nostalgia or is really scared of nostalgia. So, and the reason why I got to thinking about that particular argument is when you take a look at the long history of nostalgia, which is a word and an emotion that only dates back to the late 1600s. When you look at that long history, you find many, many examples of folks like, you know, doctors and psychologists and jurists and military leaders, all of them being very anxious about nostalgia, trying to figure out ways to stop it, to keep people from experiencing it so that progress can move forward. Because the idea was that this particularly past-looking emotion, nostalgia, was going to be an obstacle to progress. And so my typical history of the emotion is to say, well, at some point, maybe 19th, maybe 20th century more likely, there's a shift that occurs and people are no longer trying to stop nostalgia. Instead, they're trying to sort of spread it, promote it around, you know, get people to feel nostalgic so they'll, you know, make consumer choices like watch rebooted movies and series like Stranger Things or whatever. And so my argument is to say, well, maybe that's not the case. Maybe in fact, we today are just as anxious about nostalgia as we were back in the old days when doctors, for example, these medical professionals like psychiatrists, psychologists, folks like Hans Gross and a cast of other characters, a psychologist named Kretschmer and Conklin and all these older positivistic writers of the late 19th, early 20th century. A lot of them are really, you know, freaked out about nostalgia. Maybe we're very much like them, but instead of trying to cure it out of people or punish it out of people, maybe instead what we're trying to do is give people what we think they're nostalgic for. More Star Wars, more rebooted representations of the past, so that they're not nostalgic for it any longer. And that is what I'm calling foreverism. So that, you know, to understand that, we have to kind of go back in time a little bit and look at how people were writing about nostalgia back in the day and understand that we're kind of doing the same thing maybe today, but instead of trying to like prescribe some sort of, you know, medication for nostalgia, instead we're going to say, hey, hungry for nostalgia? Here's more of the past, so that you're not hungry for it anymore.
And that hunger, actually, by the corporations serving what they believe people want as nostalgia, they're actually commercializing an idealized version of the past, right? And so that evolution from medical diagnosis to commercial term doesn't just happen overnight, right? So can you kind of trace how that evolution happens?
Yeah, it kind of tracks with like the broader change from like what to use an overused term, like what Foucault called like a society of discipline and punishment, you know, where, you know, back in the day, abnormal or non-normative behaviors and emotions were framed as abnormal. And the way to get rid of that is to kind of straighten you out and almost like, you know, beat the abnormality out of you or what have you, or cure it out of you in some way so that you could be like a stand-up functioning member of society that's very much coded progressive and masculine and white and, you know, able-bodied, et cetera. A shift from that, which that kind of way of thinking pathologizes certain things like depression, nostalgia, anxiety, and ignores broader kind of social causations of those conditions. A shift from that to more of a corporate model, a model of giving people like what they allegedly want. And there's sort of a trade-off here. So on the one hand, it's like I'm no longer being targeted as an abnormal person if I feel emotions that challenge, you know, these progressive dogma. But at the same time, it's almost like a new weapon disguised as something that's everybody's okay with and that's evenly distributed. And so nostalgia is a part of that shift as well. Now we can talk about nostalgia. We can even, you know, indulge in it, whatever. But the purpose is kind of to do the same thing, which is to say, here is a lot of the past for you to have access to so that you don't have to long for the past anymore. Kind of a new twist on an old formula.
So the evolution to a commercial term is a new twist on an old formula, and it presents itself in interesting ways. How do IP-fueled universes, which you write about in the book, like Star Wars and the Marvel Cinematic Universe, actively work to prevent nostalgia in what you are calling foreverism?
That's a good question, because if we had been having this discussion a few years ago, I would have been like, what are you talking about? Like, of course that stuff is meant to spread this emotion around. That's the point of it. And then I did this thought experiment, which I lay out in the book. And it, admittedly, you know, I tell people who I've talked to about reading this book, I said, if you can get through the first like 25 pages or so, you're good to go, you know, but this is sort of like a test book, you know, whatever. So anyway, it takes a lot of framework. I do this thought experiment where I say, okay, look, every time a new Star Wars series or a movie is released, you can read a lot of articles that get written about the nostalgia of Star Wars, the Star Wars universe or whatever. It's either accusing it of nostalgia. It's just a bunch. They're just trying to relive the original again and they can never do it. So here's a bunch of repeats. Okay. Or so they accuse it of nostalgia. They might even praise it for its nostalgia. You know, it's just a good old fashioned nostalgia. Let's go get the kids and let's go see the latest Mandalorian season or whatever, because I watched the originals when I was younger and I'm going to pass them on to my children, whatever. Okay. So you can read, there's a lot of this nostalgic discourse about something like Star Wars. And I did this kind of thought experiment where I said, you know, if nostalgia is the emotion that we experience when something that is not normally present in our daily lives becomes present in our daily lives, either momentarily, right in front of us, maybe as like a wistful memory, whatever, but it is normally absent and it makes a reappearance and we feel that tug toward the past. If that's how we might define it, which is, I think that's how I define it, then how could anyone actually be nostalgic for Star Wars if there's a new movie or series being released all the time. It does not allow one to actually sit with the yearning without new Star Wars in the present for the conditions of nostalgia to actually take place. And I think about being a younger person living between the original three movies that came out in the late 70s, early 80s, and then the prequel trilogy that came out in the 2000s. And there's like still a lot of Star Wars being circulated in the 90s and like, you know, merchandising, novelizations, things like that. But in terms of like the big ticket items, like the movies themselves, it's like, will they ever make more? Was that it? And so there might be a nostalgic longing to experience that once again. That seems to me like that would be a time in which a person would experience nostalgia. But in a time in which there's lots of these big ticket items, movies and series, canonical kind of installments in the overarching story being released all the time, it's a present thing. It's not something that's normally absent in our lives. It's as present in our lives today, more so now than ever before. And so I started to think about nostalgia in that way and say, you know, so we're kind of mislabeling what's going on here with something like cinematic universes. Maybe it's not exactly an engine for spreading nostalgia, but instead one that tries to stop the spread of nostalgia.
I think the commodification aspect here is really where the shift comes from, because nostalgia was, as you write, commodified as a way of experiencing a thought process of the past. Like, it's a very meta experience. But the idea of foreverism is no longer meta, because it's just the continuation of everything. So it's almost like this elimination in a way, because the MCU is this process in which they're taking content from all through the corpus of comic books, which is like every version of it and every writer's version of it, any variant or Earth in every universe. And they only have these three-digit planets that are in there now, but they have, like, in theory, infinite number of experiences. And in one of the Spider-Man, the animated sequel, they have 2099's character along with the main characters. What I find interesting is that we are no longer looking at it in the terms of, like, content, but sometimes we're looking at it in terms of, like, how do we keep track of it and actually create this mental narrative in our head. So if you eliminate nostalgia, at least nostalgia was self-contained. You know, you could keep it in your head. You knew where the stories were. You could imagine it and dream of it. But in a world without nostalgia and foreverism, is it possible to keep storylines contained? Or is it just an unlimited version of whatever you imagine can happen?
That's a good question. And I'll just say that the self-contained aspect of nostalgia, I think that's a good way to put it, because I do think that that's also part of that the emotion's danger, is the fact that it can sort of trap people in these very self-contained ways of imagining the past. Like, I knew the story of the past. You know, America was better. We just got to get back there to it. That's sort of I think that's the danger of what nostalgia can do. But it's equally dangerous to kind of live in a time in which the conditions for even longing for some representation of the past that might give a person some sort of stability in a relatively unstable present, in which, you know, a time in which those conditions aren't possible, that too is equally dangerous. And you're right. One of the consequences of this is almost an inability to kind of keep up with the narrative of the present, if you will, like try to think about the present to see if it can make sense. And we see this play out in our stories, like stories that are present in the MCU. I mean, you know, if you were to kind of drop into one of these installments, one of these movies, and start watching, it's a really interesting watch. And I'm honestly more unfamiliar with the MCU than maybe some folks, but I'll do this occasionally where I'll try to watch a Thor 3 or whatever just to see what's going on. And I kind of vacillate between two different feelings. I either am very confused because I don't know the literature. You know what I'm saying? It's almost like reading an academic paper. If you don't know the field, you might be kind of lost. Or I'm a bit bored because the screenwriters know maybe that not everyone's a diehard fan of the, you know, MCU. And so they have to almost over-explain the events of the movie for people to maybe know what's going on. And both of those aren't enjoyable experiences for me. When I want to watch something, I'm having a better time if I'm more like drawn in by maybe some mystery or bewilderment, but not like I don't know what's going on or I'm bored or something. So we see this play out throughout entertainment media. What are the consequences of not being able to have kind of like self-contained stories founded on nostalgia is perhaps stories that are really complex and that one needs like a PhD in the MCU to understand.
Yeah. Well, let me detach it a little bit from the content then, because I think one of the business aspects of this is the intellectual property that you bring up. Like the idea that these characters that are on screen aren't just characters from comic books. They're the humans that play the character. And that dreaming of the past, that desire to see Mark Hamill or Tobey Maguire, like depending on what universe you want to play with. When I watched Spider-Man No Way Home with the several Spider-Men that appeared in it, if I were to come to that movie disconnected from the MCU and just watch it, I wouldn't be watching a movie. I'd rather be watching what I'm actually watching is a business deal. I'm actually watching several companies working together in real time in front of my screen, but performed in comic book language. And so I think the idea of disconnecting, and like I want to bring back a thought here, which is that we shouldn't get nostalgic for nostalgia either, because obviously that's just like code for fascism. But the idea of having no content, but rather business deals, is the idea that we're unlocking what would be the box of properties in order to make sure that the universes continue in every branch possible. So Disney itself becomes this umbrella of continuation, but it has to then make handshakes with other companies because it has to borrow these things for its continuation of forever. Like, what does that mean for the rest of the quote universes, everything from the Star Wars or whatever else Disney acquires? I mean, it could potentially acquire Flow from Progressive and create the Progressive Cinematic Universe. I mean, what universes aren't available to them to continue into foreverism?
Yeah, I mean, anything that has the possibility to be franchised can then be made into a franchise and kind of synergistically, you know, looped in together to create, as you say, vehicles just for IP and vehicles for stars too. Like that's the thing also, is I find myself, I don't know anything about the John Wick movies, although I see that they're pretty popular, but it's like, oh, well, now I have to go see John Wick 4 or whatever, because imagine seeing Keanu Reeves, you know, like being able to just be a older, cool actor who in his spare time plays bass and watching him up there. It's the same thing with like the Rolling Stones too. Like, you don't have to be a Rolling Stones fan, but like, you better go see them live. There's one last chance, or you better get the new record, because it's literally just about consuming the idea of a foreverized product. Like, they're still going, they still got it. Can you believe it? You know? And so the idea of like watching business deals go down, a consequence of this is that a lot of the big budget entertainment media financed by Disney, Warner Brothers, etc., they get in the business of what Kathleen Kennedy, the CEO of Lucasfilm, calls persistent storytelling, which is story. I mentioned it in the book. It's like storytelling that keeps going. It doesn't end. So no more traditional trilogy arcs, like nothing like that. Instead, it's just sort of like continuation. And that's the business model. That has at least been the business model. Like Lucasfilm, it's been the business model with Marvel. It might not be forever, to use the term, but just for right now, that's sort of just been a trend. I think they would like for it to keep being a trend because it makes them money. And it turns out to be quite successful, and they don't have to necessarily roll the dice on, quote, new ideas. And the thing is they could create new ideas, but it's always kind of within, like you said, a certain language, comic book language, or within the language of a recognizable IP. But that's one of the big differences between foreverism and like other anti-nostalgic processes like preservation or restoration, which I talk about in the book, is the big difference is that with foreverism, they could actually give you new ideas. Here's a new story in the Star Wars universe with characters that you may not know about. Maybe diehard fans might know, but other people might not. And it's new, but it's still within the closed kind of yet ever expanding universe.
Right. I think that's an important aspect here that we have to keep in mind, which is that Disney's container over copyright, which is like the ultimate preservation tool, and their willingness to absorb everything at the same time to create unlimited amounts of content. But within the Disney Princess, Disney Prince categories, you know, it has to be contained in the Disney mentality, which is, I think, most visible in the latest errors that they're going through with their Jonathan Majors and Kang storyline, which can be easily fixed by simply shrugging and being like, well, that's the multiverse for you. But that kind of aspect of buying into characters that are human beings that have real world things is like the cost of foreverism isn't just the cost of content, but the cost of the insurance on a human being to continue playing this. Because as you mentioned about like the desire to see Keanu as he ages into this great maturity of roles, where in the 1990s, he wasn't a well-liked actor at all. So we have no nostalgia for a past version of Keanu. We only have the desire to see him in the present. And now that we have this ability, how long do these characters become forevered? And we'll get to this in a little bit with the idea of like restoration being synthesized too. But this seems a bit costly to me. Like the idea of this, it seems like an unsustainable model to do foreverism inside of this.
I do agree. And I think like if you listen to, you know, I'm not one to always like lend a sympathetic ear to like a very rich actor complaining about the conditions on set not being great or something. But I do quote a few actors in foreverism who have spoken about how difficult it is to be in some of these movies and to kind of see under the hood a little bit of just how difficult it is to not just keep everything straight in terms of storyline, but also to be able to make last minute adjustments, etc. And, you know, there are like people who have worked on Marvel films and like digital effects and such who have opened up about just how volatile that industry is and even toxic. And all of this is well documented. And so it is. It's very costly. It costs lots of money. It costs lots of time and stress. And the ultimate kind of gamble is, yeah, like we could replace Tom Holland with somebody else that comes along, and somebody else that comes along that's younger could certainly be folded into, you know, the universe in some way and be their own, have their own star power, be their own star. But then also it's like we've put a lot of investment into Tom Holland, and if Tom Holland has a team of people whose job is to make sure that he continues to get work and like ages the correct way as this actor, then that's what they're going to do. And it becomes its own kind of spectacle. So yeah, it's this weird kind of mixture of like, we still are obsessed with like youth, but also with the idea that like youth can persist past that.
Let's dive into some of the stories of the actors that you were discussing and how this plays out on set in real time, because you detail a great story about the differences between Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings trilogy in the early 2000s and the subsequent Hobbit trilogy during the 2010s. And what were some of the key differences from the perspective of those actors that were on set that really inform the presence of foreverism? And how does that shift the actual practice of acting?
That's a good question. And there's this really great quote from Ian McKellen when he was playing Gandalf in the original Lord of the Rings trilogy and then the Hobbit trilogy that came out a little while later, the early 2010s, I think. And there's this quote where he's talking about how when he was shooting the Lord of the Rings, he said he didn't remember using green screen as much to shoot the first three movies, but that when he was on the set of The Hobbit, he almost only shot on green screen exclusively and found himself in these just lime green rooms with the characters who played the Hobbits were essentially like on little sticks with like their photos of the characters' faces like taped to the sticks. And when one of the characters would talk to him, like a light would light up and then he would know to look in that direction to talk to. And then, you know, later on, they would digitally edit in the Hobbit characters on the set with Gandalf, along with the whole background of the wherever he was in the green screen. I mean, it's kind of absurd when you think about it, but Ian McKellen thought it was absurd too. And he talked about being on the set of The Hobbit and breaking down and like weeping and being like, he even said like, this is stretching my mental limit to be able to like act when I'm not really around anyone and I'm in no context, I'm in no environment. And he was like, this is not why I became an actor. And like, yeah, I mean, Ian McKellen is one of the great stage actors, one of the great Shakespearean actors, you know, and I can imagine that he was pretty stressed trying to believably act as Gandalf in the Hobbit movies. But the thing is that Peter Jackson did rely on green screen while shooting Lord of the Rings. But, you know, Ian McKellen's memory of it was that if he was on top of a mountain delivering a speech, he would actually shoot it on top of a mountain. And so there's a bit of misremembering there, but there's also a shift from like, let's make three Lord of the Rings movies, each one sort of matching the three, you know, books that were written originally, to then taking something like The Hobbit, which is one book, stretching it into three movies, and essentially shooting a good majority of it on green screen. And to me, I say in the book, that's kind of like a shift from the traditional trilogy arcs, something like Star Wars, to something a bit more foreveristic in which these standalone books and comic books or novels then get stretched to accommodate, you know, 8+ hours of runtime. And in fact, that was even a criticism of The Hobbit, was that it would stretch too thin. And I do wonder, you know, when it comes to like the rebooting and the persistent storytelling of Star Wars, the MCU or whatever, at what point does it spread itself so thin that people become bored with how mundane the story might become?
Yeah. And I think even from a commercial perspective, you're seeing the decline of many of the MCU films, and the TV shows are suffering. And I think there's maybe a tendency or a tension between the studios, which in the case of The Hobbit and there being an increased green screen presence, the actors are basically saying there's far less of the reasons why we decided to get into acting present in our acting environment, at the same time that the studios gain more and more control over not just what's being shot perspectively for that film, but that data, which they then have control over to either train AI data sets to develop and deploy in the future and more foreverism, or to manipulate into totally different contexts and ways, whether it be digitally placing Ian's voice in another film or commercial or product or at large. And I feel like oftentimes when the studios are attempting to chase or trying to scrape the bottom of the barrel to create these forever universes, then they're also undermining audience integrity, and the audiences are beginning to notice and they're saying, well, what about good storytelling? Right?
Yeah. It's true. I mean, I remember when I was really starting to think about this book, I was getting my hair cut at the time, and there was somebody in the barbershop with me who was talking to my barber about one of the latest Star Wars series or something. And, I hadn't seen it, but I heard them talking about it, and they just kind of went back and forth for the entire time that I was getting my hair cut and really complaining about what they had watched and how not good it was. And it was just like nothing but criticism. And that's something that I encounter a lot when I speak with people who are fans of these franchise universes, is just like endlessly being let down. And I do think that that's part of the deal here, is that the larger media corporations understand this. They don't have to put out a good story or a good product, because they know that just by putting it out and releasing it, that there will be podcasts. Look at us doing it right now. You know, podcasts, there's going to be YouTube videos. It'll be all over social media. It'll be in my barbershop of people just talking about it. And that itself keeps it alive, you know, until it's forgotten. And then the next one comes out and then no one talks about Loki season one anymore or whatever, you know? And so it's like easily forgotten, but in the moment, it's like a period of great intensity and hype and conversation. That's kind of part of the process.
In a way, it's also sort of helpful for your criticism that's very well put about Whedon speak. That is a sign of the early 2000s, when this nostalgic period was like really starting to resurface, when a lot of the rebirth of past media was basically becoming a commodified sector. And so they were bringing in people who were half in, half out, like people who touched the past and the present at the exact same moment, and were able to bring that in. But Whedon speak, the way it's described here, is fill the gap with dialogue, you know, just a constant blathering. And that's kind of what foreverism feels like to me, is that wherever there's space to fill. And if we have content, why not use that content to fill that space? To me, it's a bit sad, to be honest with you, because to jump from that is, I want to just read, I know this is two parts here, but like just to read this quote you have here about the Beatles Get Back documentary that was done by Peter Jackson. And you write, the Beatles Get Back isn't a documentary. It does not present a record of the past. It foreverizes the past through intensive restoration techniques, thus making the past feel more present. So on the idea of like filling the gaps with dialogue, like wherever there isn't dialogue, are we at the point now where they're just going to fill those spaces with dialogue and create the mayonnaise style of Whedon speak for everything?
Yeah, I mean, the Beatles Get Back is filling the dialogue, filling the history of the Beatles with something that, yeah, might be interesting to watch, but you start to run out of things to talk about with the history of the Beatles, to the point where everything has been talked about. Well, let's talk about that one time Paul McCartney ate that bad Reuben, you know, and had the stomach ache, and we'll do a whole documentary about, you know, when someone came up with the Jordan sneakers, you know, and it'll just be a whole 2-hour movie about us being like, what if we made these sneakers, you know? And again, all it is just a way to sell Mattel product. You know, I mean, like when Barbie kicks off the Mattel universe, it's done with a big Barbie statement movie that honestly feels very big and broad and kind of like a moment you can't miss. But over time, if Mattel does what it wants to do, you'll see more and more kind of niche Barbie spinoffs from there. And, you know, to some degree, this is really nothing new. We've had spinoffs of things for quite some time, but it sort of becomes the standard operating system for how so many of the major media franchises work. Any, you know, from streaming platforms to Paramount Plus to Warner Brothers to whatever, you know. And so it is all about kind of filling the gap in the history, making the story linear and coherent, and doing so makes the story more complex. You know, suddenly now all the Beatles books have to get revised now that the Get Back documentary comes out, and itself as a documentary is popular not just because it provides, maybe it like puts a brick in the wall of the history of the Beatles, not to confuse metaphors here, but it doesn't just do that, but also it like renders a new version of the Beatles through this kind of like cutting edge AI restoration process.
This leads to your very apt point about the idea of what this does to the planet. And you have a quote from George Monbiot in there. There is no way it's still on the planet. And your idea that this creates more commodification, or the idea of forever commodification, unlimited commodification, means that in the Barbie cinematic universe made from toys, we'll produce more toys, which will produce more content, which will produce more toys. And the plastic doesn't go away, and nor does the story. So it almost seems like we're watching the, so here's a movie reference, insider reference, almost watching the prequel to WALL-E happen in real time, you know? So as we experience the commodification of Earth through its waste, through its foreverness of content, and are we able to wrap our mind around the idea of foreverism? Or is that a possibility?
I mean, I do think so. I mean, I joked like the first, you know, 25 pages of this book, so there's a lot of framework building. And yeah, that's true. But it's essentially to get to a point where I'm talking a bit about things that I think a lot of people experience daily, which is bombardment of intellectual properties, franchising or you know, enclosure of things that weren't normally commodified and then become commodified, our communication, how we untold histories of certain bands like the Beatles getting closed, other news stories and franchise universes getting closed, how we talk about those things are enclosed now on social media and such. And so, yeah, you know, that's something that I think people can wrap their head around. I think what gets to be a bit difficult is understanding, kind of doing the flip a little bit. And maybe I could be dead wrong, and I'm willing to accept that, you know, but to just try the experiment of flipping it around and saying, actually, instead of saying this is just media companies trying to promote nostalgia as a, you know, business tactic or something, or like a, you know, something to draw people to consuming these products. Instead, we might see them as just one weapon or one method in a long line of methods to try to extinguish, you know, this really complicated, rightfully so, kind of scary emotion at times, easily weaponizable, just like something like anger, you know, and it's kind of a new way to maybe do that. But it doesn't feel like that. It registers like an even distribution of nostalgia. Let's all get together and consume the latest rebooted thing, you know? But then there's real like planetary consequences. Like I love, you know, Naomi Klein just recently did an interview and somebody asked her about the Barbie movie. And she said, I hate to be like that, like no fun liberal, but yeah, like at the end of the day, this just sells a bunch of plastic dolls, you know? You know? So, and I mean, it's like, I agree with her. It's like, yeah, I hate to be that person, you know, but it really, it's true. And so like the products are meant to be sold. They don't go away. They have a physical material form on the planet. Like Georges Monbiot says, it doesn't go away. But even the, like, even just the basic like memories and experiences of this endless kind of rebooted content, they don't go away either. You know, we experience them, we get hyped about them, and then they're gone and it's on to the next one. And what we leave behind isn't necessarily like a coherent history from which we can draw. Instead, a number of memes and viral trends and things that are here today and gone tomorrow. How do you, you know, narrativize that to try to have a history of the recent digital age? That's very difficult, I think.
Yeah, nearly impossible. You were the person doing it best, though, at this very moment. And I want to try to put a bow on everything that we've talked about, because despite it being a very fun and light conversation, we're grappling with some very heavy concepts. And so it's not just foreverism that you're discussing in this book. It's also this term called nowism. So can you walk us through nowism and how it parallels foreverism?
Yeah, the term foreverism actually comes from this document that was written by Trend Watching, that like trend forecasting site, back in like 2009. It essentially was saying like, hey, what if instead of as PR people, instead of giving people what they want now, the instant now of capitalism, it's here, it's gone. What if we tried to maintain a little bit more continuity? And they were calling this foreverism. And I kind of took that seriously to think about that, kind of proved to be true in some senses. But that doesn't mean that the nowism, sort of like the foil to foreverism, didn't go away. And in fact, Trend Watching also wrote a publication around that time on nowism to say, you know, in some cases, people don't want something that lasts forever. They want something that they can easily replace. And in a lot of ways, like, that's kind of how we conceptualize capitalism, is as a nowist system, something that is all about, like, if my phone breaks or something, I don't go down to the phone person to get it repaired. I just go get a new phone. Very, very now, here and then gone. Not a lot of attachment to things. And it's the consequences of this is that, you know, landfills fill up and all of that. What I say in the book is that, like, foreverism and nowism work together. And things that oftentimes we think are, disposable and very nowist, throwing away a piece of plastic, is very much just foreverism. It moves, like Georges Monbiot says, from one place to another place on the planet and stays there, you know, for a long time, if not forever. For a really long time. I write in the book about, you know, stuff like nuclear waste, even forever chemicals, microplastics, things that, you know, they're out of our sight, but they exist somewhere, and that somewhere might be, you know, for a very long time, if not, quote, forever. But anyway, foreverism and nowism work together. And part of the confusion of living in our world today is sort of being yanked between the two all the time.
In closing, how do we resist foreverism?
Well, it's important to recognize that we're living in a period in which some more reactionary political people, corporate, you know, influences are really triggered by human emotion. And except for maybe one, which is like happiness. Okay, so positive emotional experience. Nostalgia does not always elicit a positive emotional experience. Neither does anger. Neither does sadness, you know. If you see those emotions as threatening, like, the civilized order, don't get too mad about things. Don't long too much for parts of the past that maybe, when conditions were maybe better in some sense, maybe not. But don't kind of get too emotional in public, because that might challenge the status quo. Like, don't demonstrate, don't organize, whatever. Okay, if that's the way you see things, then yeah, you're very much like the old positivist people in the 19th and 20th centuries, these psychiatrists and such we were talking about earlier, who were really threatened by emotional expression that they saw as non-normative. Nostalgia was one of those. And so it's important to recognize that we're kind of living in a time in which there is a war on emotion, and that we're kind of caught in the middle trying to figure it out. Like, what do we do with it? Do we suppress it? Just get rid of the nostalgia. It's bad and whatever. Do we try to vent it and amplify it? Like, I'm just going to sit in this room and watch one rebooted thing after the other and cry because I'm not a kid anymore or something, you know? Or do we have to somehow reappraise the emotions that are human, are a part of our experience, and yet are oftentimes being told, you know, but don't get so angry about that. It's like, well, I'm angry because, you know, it's like there's lots to be angry about in terms of widespread reactionary movements, capitalism sort of laying waste to the environment, et cetera. And so the way that I kind of end the book is by saying, like, we have to have some conversations about emotion and about what the function of emotion is in political discourse and so forth. Because, yeah, we could, like, hate on the MCU or Star Wars all day long, and I'm annoyed by that stuff as much as anybody else is. But yet we do see kind of like a political foreverism play out, where candidates, you know, in the United States already, I mean, for years, but even once again in the run-up to another presidential election, promising to return people to the past, which is absolutely a foreverist promise. Are you nostalgic for things? It used to be better. Follow me. I'm going to be the one to kind of take you back there. And then you won't be nostalgic for it anymore. Once again, eliminating those conditions. We have to have conversations about whether that's an appropriate thing to show up in political discourse or not.
Yeah, Grafton, thank you so much. This was really, I agree sincerely. This is a really good topic to continue our discussion about.
Thank you all so much. I'm happy to talk more about it.
Thank you for listening to the Digital Void podcast. Make sure to grab Grafton Tanner's new book, Foreverism, available everywhere January 23rd. We'll see you soon.